Welcome back to the program. It's hard to imagine that for young people growing up today with the Middle East being the center of American military and foreign policy concerns, that for over 50 years and eight presidents, Cuba has been the center of American concern. 90 miles off America's shores, for the entirety of the Cold War, it represented the penultimate point where Americans and Soviets were eyeball to eyeball. Today, when celebrities travel to Cuba, some try to make an issue of it, but most people wonder what all the fuss is about. Is that progress? Has Cuba changed? Have Cuba-American relations changed? Or is it just some kind of collective Cuba fatigue and amnesia? We're going to talk about all of this today with my guest, Julia Zweig. Julia Zweig is the Nelson and David Rockefeller Senior Fellow for Latin American Studies and the Director for Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. It is my pleasure to welcome her here to talk about her book, Cuba, What Everyone Needs to Know. Julia Zweig, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Delight to have you here. It does seem that if we look at Cuba today and some of the issues that we still talk about with Cuba, it's not that different than what we might have talked about 5 years ago, 10 years ago, even 20 years ago. It seems to be frozen in amber in some respects.
Well, the conversation has been frozen in many ways because our domestic politics here in the United States have given successive presidents the impression that they risk themselves politically should they start to change the conversation. That's one reason. Another reason is that, you know, your introduction, you mentioned the Middle East, that Cuba is not of great strategic importance to the United States. And so the leaving it frozen in amber comes at fairly low cost, or that's been the calculation at least since the end of the Cold War. And on the Cuban side, things have been also, I mean, we have to say, we've had Fidel Castro in power until 2006. His brother Raul, and I'm sure we'll talk about this, has begun to change things slowly, but Cuba has itself been evolving quite slowly until very recently. So both Cuba and the United States almost have had a stake in a very slow pace of a change in that conversation.
The other side of this is the degree to which it is also caught up in domestic politics in Cuba, and that making the United States kind of an ongoing boogeyman has certainly helped those in power in Cuba as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that has been the case since the very beginning, where Cuban nationalism, which is very strong in any case prior to the revolution, the entire span of the 20th century and the late 19th century with Spanish domination, nationalism is the core of Cuba's identity. And as the United States, when the revolution took place, just started to sort of crack down in various different ways to try to thwart Fidel Castro, overthrow the revolution, I think Washington just fed him a smorgasbord of delicious goodies that he could use to gin up nationalism. And now, after 50 years, it's very hard to undo that as well, because Cubans, at least politically, are conditioned to see the United States, as you say, as the boogeyman. And that's changing under Raul Castro, too, I would say, because it has been very clear in the last 5 years that he's trying to take the focus off of the United States as the cause of all of Cuba's problems and put the focus on Cuba itself as the source of where problem solving needs to come from.
And yet, even though this current administration, the Obama administration, has made some overtures with respect to Cuba in terms of allowing remittances, lifting the travel bans for families, and even looking towards Cuba becoming part of the OAS, it doesn't seem to have been met with a corresponding action at all on the part of Cuba.
Well, let's unpack that, because I think that's real. It's really great that you raised it. You know, so Obama came into office and he eliminated restrictions by Cuban Americans to travel to the island and now allows them to send as much money and remittances as they want to. And so we've seen, as of the end of last year, upwards of 400,000 Cuban Americans visiting the island and sending up probably about $1 billion in remittances, which the Cuban government has allowed, because it's opening up the private sector, opening up the small business space, allowed Cubans to invest in new small businesses. So did Raul Castro not respond reciprocally to that gesture? Well, he responded indirectly for his own interests, his own assessment of what the economic reform process should look like by allowing Cubans to travel there and allowing Cuban American investment basically to support the buildup of new private sector. So I'm not sure he didn't respond, but for face saving reasons, he's not going to respond and say, oh, thank you, President Obama, now we're going to open up the private sector because you're helping us to do that. That kind of dynamic's never going to happen. On the LAX front, look, you know, I think the Cuban government can plausibly say that it has no interest in coming back to a U.S.-dominated multilateral institution, but at the same time, behind the scenes, and I've written about this, behind the scenes, when that happened in 2009 also, and what happened was a resolution was voted on, I think unanimously, to say that should Cuba choose to follow X, Y, and Z kind of democratic path, it can come back to the OAS. Cuba didn't register an objection. It can plausibly say it doesn't want any part of it. But in fact, behind the scenes, the Latin Americans wouldn't have worked with Washington to make that happen unless Cuba had, you know, given its wink and nod. So, but the broader issue is, should Cuba change because Washington asks it to? And I think that formulation is exactly wrong. I'm not saying you're wrong, but I'm saying that that kind of expectation that Washington asks and therefore Havana will change is not going to be what's going to get these two countries to a better open relationship.
And yet the corollary of that in some ways was true during the Bush administration, in that Cuba did react negatively in that case to certain actions taken by the Bush administration. Even the actions in Iraq had an impact on Cuba. So clearly Cuba can be responsive to what's going on in Washington on the negative side. The hope would be, of course, that it might also work on the positive side.
You've definitely done your homework. Yeah, Cuba was, you know, registered its strong objection to the war in Iraq, and it even sort of within about a couple of weeks of the initial invasion in Iraq, arrested 75 people who it alleged were part of Washington's own regime change shenanigans in Cuba, believing that in the Bush-Cheney-Rumsfeld era, talking about regime change and rogue states with Cuba on the terrorist list, the State Department's terrorist list, it was a little bit dangerous to allow Cuba, Washington to support dissident activities if, in fact, that could lead to military action. I mean, that was the calculus there. But I think on the positive front, there's something that's changed pretty dramatically only last year, and that has shifting things around a bit. And that is that in 2012, Obama won almost 50% of the Cuban American vote in the state of Florida. That's on the one hand. That's in the United States. That has freed the politics. That's freed the political thinking in the White House about the latitude it might have to take some significant or even modest common sense steps with respect to Cuba without incurring the wrath of Cuban American representatives in Congress whose constituents themselves are already voting with their feet and voting to put Obama back in office. In Havana, what's changed is I think Raul Castro has made very clear in a number of ways that unlike his brother Fidel, because he's 82 years old, he's now serving out his second term, he really does have an interest in having a better bilateral future between the two countries, wants to settle things before he goes and put them on a better path. And so right now what we're seeing, and it's really, really, I mean, we are talking a very short period of time, the last 6 months, the very beginning tentative steps of a change in tone bilaterally, where you do see some responsiveness to positive steps by Washington in Havana and vice versa. I'm actually quite hopeful that a positive dynamic can unfold as long as this president in the White House can get past the immigration reform bill and then move on to a couple of things that will tweak some of the Cuban Americans in the Congress, but that I think he can manage.
Talk a little bit about the nexus between policy as it relates to Washington on the one hand and South Florida on the other, and the way the two have moved sometimes in counterbalance to each other and sometimes in tandem.
Well, okay, so just going back to early history, in 1959, or really before Castro took power, Washington already couldn't really figure out who the hell these bearded rebels were, and there was already some concern in the White House that this was not going to be our people taking office should they win. And so as after 1959, and as things polarized domestically in Cuba, as the revolution radicalized, sort of at that same time, a wave of Cubans started to leave the island and left for political reasons, lost their property, had, you know, significant fights with Havana, with the new government there, and went to work early with and for the United States. So we have the Bay of Pigs invasion, we have Operation Mongoose, which was a sort of a number of different subversive actions to overthrow Castro. And Cuban Americans, or Cuban exiles based mainly in Florida, were working on the payroll of the United States government in one direction, which was to overthrow Castro. And really throughout the 1980s and into the late, although it started to change under Clinton, but through the Cold War, there was an alignment of interest broadly and quite specifically and operationally and politically between Washington and Cuban exiles, not all Cuban exiles, but many, to do away with Castro. That alignment began to fall apart in the 1990s, and I would say the kind of biggest moment in time that your listeners would remember where it really came crashing down was over the boy Elian Gonzalez, who came here. I won't go into the whole history unless you follow up with a question, but Elian Gonzalez came here with his mother, who died in the journey, and was brought to a detention center, and some relatives of his got him and brought him to their home in Hialeah. His father and wanted him back, and over the course of the year 2000, wound up after the Cuban government waged a very significant political media campaign in Havana and in the United States, resulting in a series of decisions that wound up getting the boy back to his father, and then the Justice Department and the FBI staging a raid to get the boy from the relatives, and they all went back to Havana in the year 2000. And that was enormously, that was a big blow to the traditional Cuban exile community that made Elian's future and future potentially in the United States, as opposed to going back to the Cuban gulag, their biggest political campaign probably since the Bay of Pigs, and they lost it. And they exposed themselves as looking rather crass, trying to keep a boy separated from his father. And that divided the Cuban American community very significantly. I would say Fidel is very, very good at dividing the Cuban American community, keeping his opposition off base. And since Elian's return, which is in 2000, you've really seen the diffusion of political interest. You see Republicans who were part of the hard line who are now going wealthy, Cuban American Republicans and Democrats for that matter, going back to the island, talking with the Cuban government, trying to reclaim some kind of relationship to the place, lobbying the White House to change policy. Really, the whole thing has been turned on its head, and there are very, very few prominent Cuban Americans who you see now publicly anywhere other than a few in the Congress calling for anything but a significant change in policy towards Cuba.
To what extent is it important to keep in mind the broader historical context that even predates the Cold War, the tensions and antipathy that existed between the United States and Cuba even before Castro, even before the revolution?
Well, I mean, that kind of structural, that structural relationship, I think, is very important. And, you know, you have to remember that before 1959, the American ambassador in Cuba had an enormous political role within internal politics in Cuba, and that engendered a lot of resentment of the United States. American financial and economic interests were the dominant interests, and not just, you know, sort of the vulgar gambling piece of it that people associated with the 1950s, but electricity generation, sugar, agriculture, transportation, all of the major economic interests and sources of wealth in Cuba were largely dominated by American families and companies. And that sort of set the scene. And then, you know, we can even go back to 1902, which is when the United States acquired the Guantanamo Naval Base, which has become obviously rife with negative symbolism since 9/11, but for the Cuban government has been a huge symbol of, you know, relentless imperial domination, mm-hmm. even physical domination. So the short answer to your question is that the pre-59 period is huge.
And then bringing it up to the present, talk a little bit about the business interests that have been trying to make inroads into Cuba, American telecom companies and such, and how that's playing out right now.
Well, you know, American law is a big impediment to significant American investment on the island. But I can give you an example of the range of interest that demonstrates the range of a potential interest. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is sort of no friend of socialism or communism, is in the process of organizing a delegation of American CEOs that spans almost any sector you can think of to go down to Cuba sometime this year. I don't know exactly when it's going to happen. So if you think about the proximity of Cuba as a market for American exports and the rise in tourism when the travel ban is gone by Americans, and you think about this dilapidated infrastructure in Cuba, Cuba really needs everything, and the United States is naturally positioned to provide it. So biotechnology, agriculture, we already export several hundred million dollars a year in agricultural exports. In fact, California is part of that. Under a loophole in the embargo that was passed by the Congress in the year 2000. The thing about the economic piece of it is that Cuba is, of course, a small market. So the business community in this country has been only willing to stick its toe in the water because it doesn't want to have a big political fight with the White House or the Congress, given that there are other opportunities at other places in Latin America even. Once the White House signals that it would support American business, that it would welcome seeing that American businesses are interested in investing in Cuba, that we'll see more interest from business community, and that will reinforce the kind of positive dynamic in the White House.
Where does Cuban leadership stand now? Even Raul Castro is 80. I mean, he's not going to be around forever either.
Well, no, Raul Castro, he's 82. So I think he turns 83 this summer, or maybe he just turned 82. But no, this is the end of the Castro era. Raul Castro began his second term in office in February of this year, announced that it would be his last term. Those terms are 5 years, and showed the world the successor he had designated. And his name is Miguel Diaz-Canel. He's 53 years old. Raul will leave in 2018, and that man, unless something really that I can't anticipate, and it could happen, but that man, Diaz-Canel, is likely to be the next president of Cuba. He's now the first vice president of the Council of State, which puts him in line to be Raul Castro's direct successor.
And what impact might that have, simply the change of personalities in leadership and the end of the Castros?
Well, let's see. Let's talk about the impact within Cuba, and then we can talk about the impact up in the United States and elsewhere. You know, when he was designated, not that many Cubans actually know who he is, but he had been sort of the secretary generals of the Communist Party in Cuba by province, sort of act like governors. They have a lot of operational management powers, and the job is political, but it's also sort of managerial. And he had served as a governor in two different provinces in eastern Cuba over the last 10 years, both provinces where they were doing some experimentation with not only, you know, growing a private economy, but also decentralized taxation and budgeting. So he was actually had the ability to tax, to collect revenue, and to spend the revenue on services. And he did a good job at it. He was given some space to do it by Havana, and he showed himself to be a kind of apolitical, technocratic, good manager. I think that kind of embodies what we can, not apolitical in the sense that opposed to the current system, but not running around spouting ideology, rather working hard to get things done, to be a problem solver. And I think that's where the emphasis is going in terms of the leadership positions in running ministries, running large state enterprises, and running provinces and local government, is in problem solving and is people who are not just sort of, you know, voices of ideology, but who know how to get things done. And I think, you know, I don't know what kind of a political leader he's going to be. I don't think anyone does. He was Minister of Higher Education at one point, but this will be, once he takes office, very much a collective way of getting things done at the top in Cuba. I don't see any evidence yet of a multi-party political system unfolding. And I also don't know how much political support he has across the spectrum in Cuba. And there is a political spectrum in Cuba. Some people want to move even more slowly than Raul Castro is moving in terms of the economic reforms. And there are some people who are in government service who are, you know, part of the mainstream within the Communist Party or operating in different positions who would like to see a more rapid acceleration of the reforms. So I don't know where he sits in all of that, and I can't anticipate yet what his leadership will look like on that front.
Is it fair to say that given where we are now, that if we're having this conversation 10 years from now or 15 years from now, that it will be significantly different than the conversation that took place 15 years before?
Well, absolutely. And you know, I think maybe I've understated the nature of the changes in Cuba, but I would say that it's unrecognizable by comparison to what it was in 2006 when Fidel Castro stepped aside. And when you have Cuban diplomats in Washington, for example, telling think tank audiences that they expect fully half of the economy to be in private hands 5 years from now, that just gives you an indication of the ambition that we're talking about. So it looks like the change is incremental, and it is, but I can tell you that when we have this conversation in 10 years, if we do, we may well be talking about sort of a private-public hybrid, a well-functioning market economy with a much smaller state that provides social services to those who need it, but maybe not universally to everyone. It will look radically different, and the politics of the place, I expect 15 years from now, to look quite different as well.
Julia Swag, her book is Cuba, What Everyone Needs to Know. It's just out in its second edition from Oxford University Press. Julia, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Appreciate it. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.